From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how the Trump administration is moving forward with watering down FEMA, the state prison system has a compassionate release program for elderly infirmed inmates, but it's rarely used, and Texas is preparing to go all in on ocean desal. What are the drawbacks and concerns? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Thursday, a 12-person council, which includes Governor Greg Abbott, recommended sweeping changes to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. If enacted, FEMA would scale down the federal government's role and financial obligations after a natural disaster, like a hurricane, tornado, wildfire, or an earthquake. Altogether, the recommendations would put more responsibility on states. Antonetta Caldez Vargas is the executive director of Climate Power in Action.
If I had to take a guess, I would say that none of the people that were involved in this report and are part of this council have ever experienced an extreme weather event, because of the recommendations clearly tell you that. I mean, I am talking from my home in Katy, Texas. My house flooded during Hurricane Harvey. I had to be evacuated from my home. It took me a year to rebuild, plus all the economic costs. And if you live through that, you understand what really means to just experience a climate disaster. I don't think that the people that are writing these reports and are part of this council really understand what that is like. We really need an agency like FEMA, a strong FEMA that actually is able to respond when we need it the most. And all of these changes, what they do is actually reduce the ability of FEMA to actually respond in a way that would be effective.
The recommendations would be providing states with more responsibilities, local communities with more responsibilities, and they have to come up with the financial resources more than they do today, where it comes from the federal government. How would that impact a person like yourself who went through a disaster?
Look, states have said that they are not prepared for such responsibilities, and they often lack the staff and the expertise to do that. David, when I went through Harvey, for example, one of the most immediate things that I did was actually apply for FEMA disaster relief. And I went through the process, the agency responded in time, then I had access to talk to people that had been trained to actually help me, to actually identify my needs, to respond in time, to take care of the community. I remember there was a time I was trying to remember when it was specific, or I think it was more than a month after the hurricane. And I was in a line actually for a FEMA disaster relief interview. And there was this one of my neighbors. She just came in and say, I am willing to give my house. I don't want my house anymore. She was collapsing or mostly panicking, because when you experience an extreme weather event, it's really difficult in all aspects, economic, physical, mental health, etc. And the people that were right there from FEMA were able to handle the situation very well. You experience this very human moment, and you need trained staff.
The FEMA Review Council is recommending raising the threshold by more than 50% for supporting state governments and how they handle these disasters. So they would also change in how that's calculated. That means states would only qualify with higher levels of damage. So FEMA is really looking at only stepping in when there are these major, major disasters, I guess, like we had with Hurricane Harvey. They're going to be leaving more people on their own when they face a disaster, like in Kerrville. Kerrville probably would not qualify under these new categories.
Exactly. And that is complete, like, it's so wrong to actually make a decision like that when your only criteria is, for example, having, you know, a historic 1,000-year or 500-year flood event. That is not enough because the needs are immediate. And for example, here in Houston, you have areas that experience flooding every year. You have areas that are completely in the front lines of extreme weather events. They need that disaster aid. And the way this council and the recommendations in the report, what they are doing is actually giving more power to just politicize disaster aid, which actually we have seen that happened already. If you see the numbers, for example, as of March of 2026, it was three times harder for Democratic-led states to get Trump's approval for federal disaster aid. And under these new parameters and these new rules, that would be the case also. It will be more politicized than it is right now.
Some people are calling for FEMA to become its own agency, independent from Homeland Security, as we're dealing with these bigger and bigger natural disasters that are happening more frequently, that we should be building up FEMA, not reducing it in size.
Yes, absolutely. We should be building up FEMA. We need a stronger FEMA, not a weaker FEMA. And actually, the fact that it depends on DHS, it limits its ability to actually do more and fulfill their role. If you see, for example, in a very specific example here in Texas, in the aftermath of the 2025 Texas flooding that we had here on Camp Mystic, FEMA missed nearly two-thirds of the calls for disaster assistance because the call center contractors had been fired. That cannot happen. And I think the fact that FEMA is under DHS, it has a lot of limitations because DHS is also an agency that handles, for example, ICE and immigration and customs, CBP, etc. So it's a really big agency that has been also very politicized and criticized, and that compromised the ability of FEMA to do what it's supposed to do.
Antoinette Caldez Vargas is the executive director of Climate Power in Action. The U.S. Supreme Court has restored nationwide access by mail to mifepristone until Monday, May 11th. This comes after the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals last week blocked mail delivery of mifepristone and required in-person dispensing nationwide. This is the latest round in the fight over abortion access in the nation. Norbis Flint is the president of All Above All, a national abortion rights and reproductive justice advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C.
At first, I think I explained it as a roller coaster, but now I was, as Lee says, like one of those rides that like bring you up to the top and then drop you down. That is what this last week has been when it comes to abortion access. Over 63% of folks in the country who have access to abortion are using it through medication abortion. And so we know that it's the most used. It is also incredibly safe and has been on the market for over two decades. I am quite angry, essentially at the MAGA Supreme Court that continues to go against the people's will, to ignore what people want, and to politicize our courts. And that's essentially what it is. The vast majority of people support abortion access. This is not a piece of legislation. This is a small group of people, anti-abortion folks who did judge shopping and went to the court to get this up to the Supreme Court, but then again, to take another swipe at abortion access like they did with dogs.
So you think this is politics and not medical science?
It absolutely is politics. There's nothing. There's nothing that actually has to do with medical science. Mifepristone has been on the market for, again, over two decades. that has been tested and looked at, it's abortion medication is actually safer than Tylenol. But again and again, they keep coming after this. This is absolutely political. It has nothing to do with science. It has nothing to do with keeping people safe. It is all about the MAGA Supreme Court trying to impose its will on the American public.
If Mr. Pristone is banned, that you cannot access it through telemedicine, how would that impact health care for women?
I mean, it'd be devastating. Every way in which you limit access to abortion, and particularly abortion medication, is another way in which people are not able to get the services that they need when they need them, where they need them. We know that this is not only going to be impactful in states that have abortion bans, but also in states that don't. If people have to go into brick and mortar places in a place like California or New York or Oregon, that actually puts a strain on the system. And so not only will it impact folks' ability to get abortions in places where folks have already having to travel and be out of state, it is going to hurt folks across this country. So yeah, it will be devastating. There are still options out there for people, but it also, like, we shouldn't understate that this is actually going to be really hurtful to people's ability to get the abortion care that they need.
If a woman has a miscarriage, don't they sometimes prescribe this?
Yeah.
Will they still be able to do that?
So they are banning mifepristone, so it's not on the circumstances. I think the anti-abortion folks keep trying to divorce pregnancy from abortion access, but we know that abortion access is a part of the pregnancy continuum of care, and that what this does, again, is harms care for abortion access, but it also harms care for people to getting the pregnancy miscarriage management that they need as well. It overall is hurting health care and hurting reproductive health care and people's ability to get, again, the services that they need when they need them.
Norbise Flint is the president of All Above All, a national abortion rights and reproductive justice advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. The Texas prison system has a compassionate release program called MRIS, Medically Recommended Intensive Supervision. It can release inmates who are so sick, disabled, or near death that continued imprisonment may no longer serve a meaningful public safety or punishment purpose. But an examination of the Texas MRIS program by the Texas Civil Rights Project finds it underused and calls the program a failure. Kirsten Budwine is an attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project.
Texas calls our compassionate release program MRIS. The actual name is Medically Recommended Intensive Supervision. And so it was a program that was created specifically in Texas. It was created in 1991. And the purpose of the program was to reduce incarceration costs, protect the public, and provide more humane treatment for people who are identified as special needs in a TDCJ. The way the program works is a person who fits into specific criteria can be released from TDCJ before their sentence is complete. I think you can really think about this as another form of parole, but it's specifically for people who are elderly and have specific medical ailment.
So a inmate, and they really are not, they're not a robust individual. They're not in good health. And then the state can recommend that this person be released so that basically get better health care, or they can spend time with their family in their remaining time.
The program is just a little bit more strict than that. So there are actually 9 categories total. So a person can be considered eligible for MRIS if they are elderly. So elderly is defined as 65 or older, or they're diagnosed with one of the following conditions. It's terminal illness, physically handicapped, they have a mental illness, they're developmentally disabled, they need long-term care, they have organic brain syndrome, they are in a persistent vegetative state, or they have another special need. it's not enough to just fit into one of those categories. Screening also looks at the sentence that you were given and also the criminal offense that you're serving time for. So, for example, people who are serving a death sentence or life without parole, they are not eligible for release under this program. And then you're further restricted if you're serving time for specific offenses. And the offenses that are listed is a very long laundry list. You know, pretty serious offenses. We're talking about like murder, sexual assault, like those type of offenses. If you are serving time for those offenses, you are not eligible for MRIS unless you are diagnosed as terminally ill or in need of long-term care. So say you are somebody who is 65 or older and you're serving time for one of those offenses that's listed in the statute, you are not eligible just because you're elderly. You have to be diagnosed as terminally ill or in need of long-term care. And then it's also not enough that you're eligible. You also have to go through the Board of Pardons and Paroles. So the screening is done through this sub-agency group under TDCJ called Takumi. And after they do the screening and get all the documents put together, they send everything to a special panel that falls under the Board of Pardons and Paroles. It's called the MRIS panel. The MRIS panel then determines whether they're going to release you. And they're looking at whether you are a threat to public safety. They're looking at your medical history.
Why does the Texas Civil Rights Project describe the state's compassionate release system as uncompassionate?
Yes. On paper, when I looked at other states and compared our compassionate release program to other states, we actually have one of the best programs on paper. But it's in practice where we're finding that there are a lot of barriers. For example, our interest was sparked around this program because we saw it as a program that, if operating as intended, could be a way for more people who are elderly and ill to be released back into society, back into more appropriate placements. We're seeing a graying of our prisons. The elderly population is over 24%. Now it's the fastest growing demographic. We're seeing increased medical care needs, mobility limitations, and TDCJ requesting more money for specialized housing for this elderly population. TDCJ themselves agrees that MRIS should be used more often to release elderly and sick individuals because they want the ballooning medical costs to be alleviated. And so we saw an opportunity here to look and see, like, how does the MRIS program operate in practice? So what we did is we got some referrals from an organization called Lioness. They serve women who are currently incarcerated and formerly incarcerated. And then we also did some cold calls and identified people who were eligible for MRIS based on their elderly status. But what we found is that there are a lot of barriers through this program. Some of the issues that we ran into, like, for example, when we would get a denial letter from the board. So if we had a client who made it past the screening stage and was presented in front of the Board of Pardons and Paroles, we would get a letter back, just basically like a one paragraph statement from the board saying this person was considered for MRIS by the parole board and was denied. But there was no reason stated for why they were denied release.
What is the approval rate for MRIS?
So yeah, we pulled these charts and pulled this data from the Board of Pardons and Paroles. They release a report every year. In fiscal year 2023, they had 3,084 people that were screened for MRIS. 289 of those people were presented, and then only 27 people were actually approved. And so for the elderly category specifically, in fiscal year 2022, 7 people were released. In fiscal year 2023, 1 person was released. And fiscal year 2019 through 2020, 0 people were released under the elderly category.
What's a quick reform? What needs to happen to make the compassionate release compassionate?
We really want for there to be more information released when it comes to the denial letters. People incarcerated need to know why they were denied for release under MRIS. There needs to be more training for medical staff to ensure that they understand the limitations and the barriers that come with MRIS consideration and screenings. There's a very narrow definition of terminal illness that we believe needs to be expanded.
Kirsten Budwine is an attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project. Texas is indeed running out of water. Climate change, ongoing droughts, residential growth, and the development of data centers along with other industrial water users means Texas needs to find more water. Many are looking at the Gulf of Mexico and planning for massive ocean desalinization projects. Ocean desal can provide millions of gallons of water each day, but at what cost to the environment and who pays? Evgenia Spears is the water program coordinator with the Sierra Club Lone Star chapter.
Seawater desalination has been discussed as a water supply strategy in Texas for several years. And when you talk to people about seawater desalination or about the water crisis, then people will say, well, we have access to the Gulf of Mexico, so there's plenty of water, right? Why wouldn't we just treat it and make it fresh water or drinking water? But the reality is a lot more complicated because seawater desalination is one of the most expensive ways to produce fresh water, and it also requires a lot of energy. It can also create environmental challenges that people don't always think about because, as you know, like desalination is removing salts from the water, right? So about half of seawater that is being treated that goes into the system becomes fresh water, and the other half becomes concentrated salty waste that's called brine, and it has to go somewhere. So discharging that brine into bays and estuaries, which is the most cost-effective option, can alter salinity levels and harm aquatic life. So because the water in bays and estuaries is just simply not dynamic enough in terms of mixing. So when we discharge that brine, it's heavy in salts, so it will go to the bottom and accumulate and linger and prevent the oxygen exchange in the water that could lead to the formation of dead zones, which we don't want to see. And then there is also the intake side or water diversion, like when we intake seawater for treatment. And when we pull large volumes of seawater from bays and estuaries that could trap or kill marine organisms, including plankton, which, you know, forms the base of the marine web. And the problem with this is that, first, as far as discharges are concerned, Texas doesn't have standards, water quality standards for salinity. And Texas doesn't have sufficient protections to prevent harming of marine organisms. The general recommendation is to do the seawater intake and brine discharge offshore at least 3 miles out into the Gulf. But it significantly adds to the price tag of the seawater desalination facility. So that requires additional infrastructure and so on. So it becomes very expensive, even though we have a Texas-specific study that recommended a few years ago, legislature directed Texas Parks and Wildlife and General Land Office of Texas to conduct that study. So we have the environmentally suitable zone for brine discharges and seawater diversion. But I wanted to also circle back to the surface water quality standards for salinity, because as I mentioned, those regulations don't exist in Texas right now. And there was a bill last session, House Bill 3728, which was filed by Representative Penny Morales Shaw, that would have directed FTCQ to establish such standards. However, it didn't pass. So as a result, as of right now, when seawater desalination seems to be ramping up in Texas in response to the water crisis, we don't have basic protections in place.
Ocean desal is happening around the planet. They do it in San Diego and one in Florida. It's happening. But is it that their geography is different? So Texas can't just do what they've done elsewhere. We have to consider the ecological issues that we have. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. We have to consider the unique geography as well, because we have the barrier island system, and our basin estuaries is a sort of semi-enclosed. They're not as dynamic. They can't mix that brine efficiently and minimize its impact. As I was saying, it can accumulate and linger and persist in those water systems. So that's why the general recommendation, if we want to do seawater desalination sustainably and not create additional problems along the way, then we need to discharge it out into the Gulf, at least 3 miles out. And that's what makes the Texas situation unique and more challenging, too.
Do we need to be looking at equitable ways of who pays for these projects?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm glad you brought it up. I was looking at the state water plan, at the draft state water plan that Texas Water Development Board released recently. And there are 8 seawater desalination projects in Texas right now. Five of them are located in Corpus Christi. And the total cost of all of these seawater desalination projects, there are proposals, like Texas doesn't have an operating seawater desalination plant at this point. The cost is over $11 billion for all 8. And the Inner Harbor specifically that you mentioned, I believe the cost is sitting around $1 billion right now, but it's a highly controversial project, and we'll see how it'll move forward.
But what about who pays for these things? If residential users are asked to pay for it, and then we're still providing water at a huge discount to the industrial users, is that fair?
It's absolutely unfair. You're right. So it's unfair to make residents carry the cost of industrial users, essentially. And what we've been seeing in Corpus Christi is that it's running out of water. It's really a race against time right now to figure out additional water supplies. And residents are the ones who are paying the price. They're the ones who have to cut back, and they're the ones who are paying higher bills, even though they're conserving water. Meanwhile, industries aren't, and they are using 60% of water in the region. So it's not fair. However, when the project is listed in the state water plan, like the Inner Harbor Seawater Desalination, that makes it eligible for the public money, public dollars, right?
The bottom line is that there will be public dollars funding these facilities that would produce water for industry.
Evgenia Spears is the Water Program Coordinator with the Sierra Club Lone Star Chapter. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. Download and subscribe to Texas Matters wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.